Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm your host, John McCoy, and with me this time is co-host Zach Powers.
Hi.
Hi, Zach.
Hi. Glad to be here. Glad to be here with this very long. This podcast is going to be 98% me mangling Russian names, I'm sure. But I'm excited to get the opportunity to do so.
Well, I'm sure we're all waiting with bated breath for that. But before we get into that, Zach, tell everyone where they can hear you.
You can hear me in a couple of different places. I have a presently on hiatus podcast with former Sophomore Lit guest Shannon Camp, possibly future as well. Called Stage of Fools, in which we recap a scripted e-television show, which is loosely based on Hamlet, though far, far trashier, far less dignified than Hamlet itself. If you prefer, I co-host a show called The Revisionists, which is a comedy history podcast, in which myself, my co-host, and a guest present a real story from history, and then another person presents a fake, crazy, made-up version of that story, and at the end of the episode, the third person votes on which becomes our accepted canonical history. So you can also hear me at The Revisionists.
This time, we are doing Dostoevsky's 1866 novel, Crime and Punishment. God help us. We are doing Crime and Punishment. Zach, you asked for this novel. You want to talk a little bit about your history with this?
I read this novel. It was the summer between my sophomore and junior year of high school. It actually wasn't technically assigned per se. What happened was I was given a reading list for my honors English class for possible summer reading options. Possibly because, maybe like Raskolnikov, I am slightly arrogant and slightly proud, I had elected to go with, Crime and Punishment, which was probably the longest, densest book on the list. And at the time I remembered enjoying it a fair amount, though upon rereading the same copy that I read when I was that age, I find that my notes were not particularly elucidating.
I wasn't given this in high school, but back in 1979, there was a Masterpiece Theater adaptation of this that I remember watching. I was 11, so that gives you a sense of what my childhood was like, watching Masterpiece Theater adaptations of Crime and Punishment. And it starred John Hurt. I don't know that it's available anywhere, but I remember that I watched it and I was really stricken by it. And so I went to my parents' bookshelf and pulled off their Heritage Edition copy of Crime and Punishment. And I tried really hard to get through it. And I recall having read the whole damn thing, but reading it now, I realize I must have read the beginning up to the crime part, and then I probably skipped way ahead to the very end of the book and found out what the ultimate punishment part was.
Right. The and portion takes up the vast majority of the book.
And to be fair, it's an odd book from a plotting standpoint, insofar as the titular Crime and Punishment part of it is a fairly straightforward, fairly simple story that is where the activity, such as it is, happens mostly in the protagonist's mental state. But then it is complicated just seven times over by a bunch of other domestic stuff that happens.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I had read that part of the issue with the title, which I think I have heard a few people who think that this is a much more politically minded book than it is, that it has to do with how society should react to crime or treat criminals, which isn't really the case. But my understanding is in the original Russian, the title has a kind of aspect to it that means sort of like to become something else or to change in word that fits into the word crime. So there's an aspect of crossing over or changing your nature inherent in the title, which doesn't translate at all to the English title, but gives you a better idea of, I think, the intent of the book.
I agree, and I think you bring up a really good point here, which is we are dealing with a book in translation. Specifically, the translation we are doing, we decided to use, is the Constant Garnett translation, because this was the one that you had in your paperback copy from your high school years. And
that's right.
I had to kind of laugh because I knew the name Constant Garnett really well, and I knew that I had come across her a lot, and so I looked her up, and she turns out to be this crazy person who translated nearly all of Tolstoy and all of Dostoevsky and all of Chekhov back around the turn of the century, late Victorian, early Edwardian time, and she's kind of the person who brought all these great works of 19th century Russian literature into English. So people have to thank her for that. On the other hand, today she's kind of seen as being very demure and a little bit reticent to kind of get down in the dirt with, especially with someone like Dostoevsky, who wrote about such squalid topics. Her Wikipedia page says that she would sometimes elide things that she found distasteful or that she didn't understand. So, I'm glad to have read up on her and learned a little bit about her. I can't imagine translating one of these novels, let alone all the novels she translated.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's for the most part a very sort of straightforward kind of writing style.
Right.
He doesn't go into a lot of, I mean, he essentially states what the case is in a given situation without much additional flair. Certainly very little metaphor is used in the book, except in the case sometimes of the characters talking. But in the actual narration that is not dialogue, it's extremely like he entered a room in which there was a table with three chairs around it. Very, very straightforward.
The other thing that I think is really interesting about the style of this book is it's in third person ostensibly, but it's almost entirely from the main character Raskolnikov's point of view, to the extent that from time to time when he jumps over to an event taking place somewhere else, I just was completely thrown out of the book. I was like, what the hell's going on here?
Right.
Because all along the way, we have a narrator who's in a similar fashion to Jane Austen's free indirect style. The narrative voice takes on some of the opinions of Raskolnikov or seeks to explain his psychology from within. Then suddenly we're in a room where Raskolnikov isn't, and it just seems like, what's going on?
Yeah, there are chapters where they go to the Svidrailgalov, I want to say, is the name of the character, or the Luzin character for short periods of time. And it is a little jarring because it's almost completely within the point of view of Raskolnikov, true, but also it reflects his bouts of mania to the point where it's inside his mind and reflecting his own mental state. So when you're going to a completely different character, it is a little jarring. And there's strange points, this only happens a couple of times, where the narrator will speak in the first person and say, I do not want to discuss that, or we shall not go into that right now. But it only happens once or twice through the run of the book, and I found it a very odd kind of break whenever that happened as well.
Late in the book, the narrator starts to discuss why the widow of Marmeladov, who is the father of Sonya, we'll get into all these characters, don't worry, everyone who's confused there, we'll talk about this, why she spent so much money on his funeral. And the narrator just starts talking about the propriety of doing so and what she hoped to do. And it's again, as you say, it's very jarring when the narrator does that. If you haven't read any Tolstoy or Dostoevsky, or haven't acted in any plays by Chekhov, let's get this out of the way. Yes, Russian names are extremely confusing. And
yeah,
and the
they especially in regards to, there's this tendency to call characters in some contexts by their last name, but occasionally, I guess in more familiar situations, you call them by both their first and their middle name. So it could be a little confusing when characters suddenly have an entirely separate name from the one you are used to them being referred to as in the book for large chunks of time. And it takes you a moment to kind of catch up mentally.
So there are these three names. There's the given name, and then there's the patronymic, which is just basically the name of your father. So if you're Ivan Ivanovich, that means you're Ivan's son of Ivan. And then you're given a family name, which is what we would consider a last name, which is what Raskolnikov, the main character, that is his family's name. His first right. name is Rodion Romanovich, but is almost never, he's almost never called by that in the book. He's almost always called Raskolnikov, which I gather has to do with the level of formality. And since the narrator doesn't assume a formality with
sure.
the character, he's going to call him Raskolnikov. But to add to all this, every name has about 12 diminutive forms, such as
sure.
Ivan. Ivan can become Vanya, but you're supposed to know that, you know, if you're a Russian speaker. In English, of course, we have diminutive forms as well, but everyone has sort of one nickname, if you have a nickname, but everyone in Russia has all the nicknames.
Yeah. It's a little, it can be a little difficult to keep up, especially when you're first kind of getting a feel for the book. And after a while, it feels much more natural because you kind of understand this kind of bizarre rule set. I mean, you are immersed in it for hundreds of pages, but initially it can be kind of difficult to keep up mentally.
Yeah. Now, this book is a very, very long book. Depending on what edition you get it in, it will run between, I don't know, around 600 to 1,000 pages long. And because of that, we will try to cover the plot rather sparingly. As we've mentioned, it has a simple plot, and then it has this complicated plot that underlies the simple plot, but mostly
yeah.
it's about our character, our guy Raskolnikov. And how would you characterize Raskolnikov?
He is, to be frank, not a particularly likable protagonist. He's extremely cut off from society. He has a huge chip on his shoulder. He's extremely arrogant. In the first pages of the book, he is described as slinking past his landlady's door because the idea of even speaking to her for a moment is so repugnant to him that he would rather sulk out quietly into the night. He describes the slums in which he lives with complete disdain, although they do sound completely horrific. He fancies himself, I suppose, the next great mind of the world, of his generation.
Yeah, this is taking place in mid-19th century in St. Petersburg, and before the book starts, Raskolnikov has been kicked out of university, and so he's an ex-student. and he has no real source of income, but he does have a very high opinion of himself, and he particularly ascribes to what we might see as sort of the emerging Nietzschean worldview, that so there are certain people who are superior people and they get to not live by society's rules. And it's funny, when I was reading at this time, I was thinking about how if Raskolnikov were alive today, he would probably be writing comments on YouTube videos, or he's got that kind of smug self-satisfaction of
absolutely, yeah,
and yet absolutely no means for supporting himself. But he's got this idea that as the superior man, sort of like Leopold and Loeb, he feels it's his right to go ahead and break society's rules. And specifically, he's got this crime in mind, the titular crime of Crime and Punishment. As the book starts, he's rehearsing this crime. He wants to kill a pawnbroker in his neighborhood, an old woman, because he has this idea that she's just vermin anyway, and why shouldn't he rid the world of this blight on society? Well, at the same time, maybe, you know, if he takes a few things,
get a little money on the side. Yeah, it's this really thinly draped philosophical sort of even utilitarian ideal for committing this murder that is so easily and quickly cast aside by even the shortest glance, that it is clearly just a selfish act, that he clearly just wants to take a little bit of money. And the fact of the matter is, he's so proud that he has opportunities to come by some amount of money by more honest means. His friend offers to have him translate some kind of treatise or something for some magazine, and he refuses the offer because I suppose he feels it beneath him. I think that in some ways Raskolnikov would actually fit in this modern kind of staple of television, like drama protagonists who are these amoral kind of tortured characters, like Walter White or even like a Don Draper. I think he would kind of fit in that stable somewhat well, actually.
Yeah, and do you think that then all the pasty white boys out there would take him on as their hero and put posters on their dorm room?
They would fail completely to grasp the meaning of. Thank God this book is so dense and sometimes difficult to get into. Otherwise, I'm sure there would be a sort of like Scarface or Breaking Bad-esque obsession among confused young white men.
Complicating matters, Raskolnikov has made the acquaintance of a local drunk named Marmeladov, and this drunk in turn has a daughter named Sofia, but she's called Sonia through most of the book, mm-hmm. because again, diminutives. And Sonia is she's literally the hooker with a heart of gold, because yeah. she's been reduced to prostitution to support her family. And Sonia will become sort of the moral center of the book as time sure. goes on. And he's also got a really, really good friend named Razumikin.
I'm roughly as lost as you with many of these names. But I do know that one thing that I guess is lost in translation a little bit is that a lot of these names do have root words in Russian that are telling of the character. And Razumikin, I guess, is his root word is supposed to be reason or reasonable, whereas Raskolnikov is schism or divided. So it's sort of that kind of old, you know, convention.
That's a good point, because in some ways Dostoevsky straddles two worlds here. He has a kind of this novel in many ways has this kind of sentimental appeal. There's a lot of coincidence that drives the narrative forward.
Sure.
So it's mm-hmm. it feels very much like an early 19th century novel in that way. On the other hand, it's highly psychological, and so much of it takes place in Raskolnikov's head, so much of it is internal dialogue, and then there are passages where Raskolnikov has dreams or people get have fever dreams where they actually hallucinate things, and it's a kind of a much more what we would consider a much more modern kind of Freudian take on things, although I don't know that Freud even exists at this point. And
no, I mean, I know that some later psychologists have called Dostoevsky kind of an amateur pioneer into the art of psychiatry, but certainly there is a great deal of following these characters around, particularly Raskolnikov, as he goes through these almost manic, depressive, rapid mood swings, just constantly shifting back and forth between this kind of delight and rapture and this angry, overwhelming bitterness and hatred.
Yeah. You have to get used to that because, as you say, that's going to be a lot of the book. And
absolutely.
I didn't have a problem with it, but talking about it now, it makes it kind of hard to put events in order because there is a kind of a sameness to a lot of Raskolnikov's sequences.
Yeah, he often just wanders out to a separate location while, I don't know, some strange event occurs upon the way that could really happen in any order.
Early on, he has a dream about a mare being beaten. You can't help but feel that this is like super Freudian. It's because
yes, absolutely. It's implied that it's not just a dream, but in fact a memory from his childhood when he saw some rambunctious drunk whose horse had been worked to the point of near death begin to beat it more and more intensely and in fact encourage the crowd around him, this bloodthirsty crowd, to join in on beating the mare while Raskolnikov wept and lamented at this horrific sight of this animal being murdered in front of it. Obviously it's supposed to be connected to the murder that at that point he is considering committing, because a great deal of the conflict is that this guy, the guy who owns the mare, keeps talking about how it's his right to kill it, that as its owner, as a person in power above it, he has the right to slowly brutalize this horse to death.
Raskolnikov has a sister, Dunya. She had a basically sexual harassment at her old job, which was in some sort of a domestic. Did they ever explain what it was she did for this family?
She's described as the governess.
So she must have taken care of kids. The husband in this had made advances on her and she had left them. And now she is going to marry this other guy. What's his name? Luzin. And that's a complicating factor that will play out in a lot of, again, a lot of coincidence in the way that that story overlaps with Raskolnikov's story. But it also, early on in the story, illustrates Raskolnikov's complete contempt for everything that's going on around him, for society. Certainly, he feels that his sister shouldn't have to marry this man simply for material gain.
And I think it speaks also somewhat to his incredible degree of self-centeredness, because upon getting this letter that she's going to marry this Luzin fellow, based on a few strange word choices that his mother makes, he immediately deems that this guy is no good, which turns out to be correct, but he also immediately assumes that the reason she is marrying him is specifically so that he can have some kind of financial gain, that she is marrying exclusively for his benefit. The idea that she is doing it of her own accord never enters into his brain at any time.
The crime. Well, his big idea is simply that he is going to go visit this pawnbroker, bring a pledge, an object to be pawned, and he's going to murder her in her apartment because she carries out her business from her apartment. And obviously he's not a criminal mastermind, because that's the extent of his ideas. He's going to pick up an axe that he has found in the groundskeeper's shed. He runs through it once. He goes to the apartment of the pawnbroker and acts super suspiciously and tells her he'll be back again soon with the pledge. And then when it actually comes to the actual crime, he basically makes a mess of it as only Raskolnikov can. Not only does he end up killing her, but her sister, Lizaveta, walks in, and so she gets axed as well. And then he has no clear plan of what he hasn't identified anything valuable to take from the apartment, so he grabs a few trinkets. Then he finds that he's left the door open the entire time, and he runs into he closes the door, and some people show up in the hall. Just by chance, he's able to hide in an apartment that's abandoned because it's being painted. The one thing I would say about this whole passage here is it's, I think, one of the more brilliantly written passages of the book. I think if you like stories like this, we mentioned Breaking Bad or a movie like The Simple Plan or any of the Coen Brothers films, which are about capers going wrong. This was a brilliant example of that, of someone who is way in over his head from the beginning.
And I think that a lot of the passage is, and in fact the lead up to the murder itself, is, as you mentioned, driven by this intense degree of coincidence, to the point where he overhears, I think the night prior to attempting to commit the murder, that Lizaveta is going to be out at exactly 7 o'clock the following night by pure chance. And he says, of course, this is the time at which I'm able to pull off this this crime. But obviously it goes awry immediately. He knows that she has a drawer and a ring of keys. And inside the drawer is a great number of rubles. And he is unable to find the key that matches the drawer, and so he just grabs these trinkets and this old purse, and these people come by with their... Yeah, it's actually fairly tense as a little section of the book, yeah. And it stands kind of in stark relief to the much more sort of long-winded and slower and very psychological portrayals of his sort of mental torment that take up most of the rest of the book.
What he's taken brings him no joy. He just hides it under a rock somewhere. And then for the rest of the book, Raskolnikov will be in and out of guilt-induced fever states. But right after having committed the murder, he is... he's completely beside himself. His friend Razumikin fortunately comes over and is able to kind of get him set up in bed, and everyone thinks he's been taken ill. No one knows exactly what's going on, but whenever anyone mentions the murders around him, he has a tendency to faint.
Yeah, he is not just in the murder itself, but beyond that, a horribly bad criminal, to the point where he starts talking in great detail about the murder with a police detective at a bar at one point, and how he would have done it and what would have motivated him to have done it if he did. And upon hearing it at a police station, he does, in fact, immediately faint.
He wanders back to the pawnbroker's apartment building, and he wanders into the apartment that he hid in and asks the painters there if anyone had cleaned up the place. So he's not keeping a low profile in any way.
But somehow he manages to get away with it, despite arousing a few suspicions. One of the more interesting things about the murder and its immediate aftermath is, one, how his sort of semi-justification, which is this kind of mix of this ubermensch philosophy and almost utilitarian idea that the pawnbroker is so vile that killing her would be of benefit to the greater society, which is kind of backed up in the fact that he even hears people talking about how they wish they could murder the pawnbroker at a bar at one point, falls away essentially immediately, especially with the intrusion of Lizaveta, who is, by all accounts, innocent, and possibly, I think the book implies, even a little bit mentally slow. I think it's possible that she has a mental disability. She's described as idiotic and unreasonably slow or something of that to that regard, but is, you know, beaten by this cruel pawnbroker woman on the regular. His fall into guilt is essentially immediate. Like, his thin justification falls away so quickly, even though he clings on to it somewhat for the next few hundred pages.
It's no longer the question of whether or not he has the right to commit a crime. It becomes, to him, the burning question is, does he have the right to lie and get away with the crime? Whether he has an obligation to confess or not. And again, I think, as you mentioned, this utilitarian side comes over. He doesn't think that anything will be served by his giving up, giving himself up.
Sure.
One of the things that I thought was kind of amusing is when Dunya, which is again Raskolnikov's sister, and his mother introduce him to this potential suitor, Luzin. Luzin is also presented as kind of a dilettante philosopher. The thing that I like about him is he's kind of a shadow to Raskolnikov. He's a
Absolutely,
jerk in
yeah.
exactly the same way that Raskolnikov is, in that he likes to armchair psychologize everyone. He likes to talk about the social order, but the one thing he does get right is he immediately pegs the crime as not the work of any professional criminals, that they had to have been one of the pawnbroker's clients. Of course, that's mm-hmm. not necessarily a brilliant conclusion
no,
to reach.
Yeah. But and beyond that, I think, well, obviously, yeah, Luzin is extremely prideful. In his first introduction, he has this sort of armchair philosophy stuff that eventually causes both Razumkin and Raskolnikov to time to turn against him, but also his arrogance and his sense of being just better than other people is just as thorough as Raskolnikov's is at his worst. It's later revealed that in one of the weird sections where they split away from Raskolnikov's point of view, the reason he was interested in Dunya is because she was poor and he could patronize her, and she would always be dependent upon him as a kind of savior, that he himself could be this exceptional figure in her life who was not only someone she loved, but rather someone who was essential to her well-being and who had pulled her out of the mire and misery that she had lived in before.
The other thing that is funny about Luzin is he's one of several characters in this book that get introduced at the very end of a chapter where they say a strange figure appeared in the doorway.
Sure,
and
yeah.
It's such an oddly clumsy construction in a way in the midst of a book that, as you say, tends to be very deadpan about everything. It tends to be
sure.
the way you locate yourself in a story as you walk into the room and they describe what's in the room. And then suddenly there's like a figure appeared in the doorway and you're like,
it's It's literally no exaggeration, the kind of cliffhanger you would expect in like a Goosebumps book that I might have read when I was a kid, like to keep the reader interested. It's just so hastily thrown in there in the last couple of sentences in a chapter.
Yeah, they do that with him. They do that with what's his name? The former employee who shows up.
You're not talking about Svid Railgalov, are you?
Right. Yes, yeah, Svid Railgalov.
Svid Rigalov.
Please forgive us.
We could call him, his first name's Arkady, which seems a lot easier.
Right. There's also like late in the story, there's a guy who just appears in the street and yells murderer to Raskolnikov. Mm-hmm. And he's also just kind of out of nowhere. He just appears. And then later we get to know who he is. I kind of wonder about that. I wonder if those were the points. This book was originally published as Dickens novels were published. It was originally published in episodes. And I kind of wonder if that marked the end of an episode or not. On the other hand, the book has these six sections
distinct
and
yeah.
But that I don't know whether that was conceived as when he was writing it or whether that came together for the collected version. The former employee of Dunya also shows up, and he was married
to the woman for, who,
right. The other character we were introduced to here is Porphyry. Mm-hmm. The magistrate who's basically the Columbo of the story.
Sure.
He's going to follow Raskolnikov around, and he has Raskolnikov pegged as the murderer pretty early on.
Yes.
And so we get like a sequence of chapters where Porphyry just like tries to trip Raskolnikov up in something or invites him in.
Yes.
To talk.
Yeah, he sets these little traps with his questions that we get accounts of Raskolnikov trying to sort of examine every word he says to try and find him in a lie or contradicting his own story. Actually, your Columbo assessment was even more apt than you might have suspected, because according to the guys who created Columbo, he was based on this character.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I believe it entirely. There was a at one point, for example, Raskolnikov admitted to the police that he had been to the pawnbroker's the night before the murder, or two or three days before the murder, which was that time when he was casing out the joint to plan the murder. And Porphyry asks, "Oh, did you see the painters there?" And Raskolnikov had to realize the painters only started their job the day of the murder. So that's the kind of level of thrilling adventure stories we get in this. Mm-hmm. I'll be honest, I could have done with a few less of those scenes, because I kind of got what was going on between the two of them rather early on. And the one thing that doesn't happen is no one is getting the upper hand here. It's sort of like the stakes are the same all the way through the book.
Yeah, this isn't the story of Porphyry at all. Like, he is obviously a side character, and it's not the story of this brilliant detective mind catching this criminal. It's the story of this criminal who has to eventually come to his own kind of rejuvenation or redemption and learn to confess on his own merits. So it is strange that so much time is committed to this game of cat and mouse, I guess just for the sake of narrative tension, but it's fairly clear from the book that the only acceptable resolution is Raskolnikov coming forward of his own accord and confessing to the crime.
In the midst of all this turmoil, Raskolnikov has become friends with Sonya after Sonya's father, the drunk, is killed in a carriage accident. Raskolnikov takes it upon himself to donate some money to their family, which makes him feel better, even though he doesn't really have any money to be giving. He gives a little bit of money that his mom gave him to her. Mm. And so there's a lot of sequences of him talking to Sonya, and Sonya again being just the sweetest little thing, and that's kind of bringing out Raskolnikov's desire to confess. Unfortunately for him, though, and again, another one of these just zany coincidences in the book, the apartment right next to Sonya has been rented by Dunya's previous employer.
Yes.
Svidrigaylov, who has shown up after Dunya as well. So Dunya has Svidrigaylov showing up. His wife has died.
Yeah.
Later we'll learn that he may have had a hand in that. He says he's here to try to apologize to Dunya, but it becomes clear very quickly that he's still hung up on her, and he wants to forcibly marry her, or if he can't marry her, as we learn later, he will assault her. So poor Dunya has him, she has Lutzen, and then and then Raskolnikov's pal that we've mentioned here before.
Yes. Razumikin
has become submitted by Dunya as well. So she's got three suitors.
Yeah, everybody loves Dunya so much.
Now there's a sequence here. This is one of those sequences where the narrator jumps in, where the narrator explains why Razumikin likes Dunya.
Yeah.
and says, well, of course he does, because he's drunk, but also because she's sweet and she has she's got money, and she's got this good head on her shoulders or whatever. It's a very strange thing where the narrator is also inviting us, the reader, I suppose, to also fall in love with Dunya.
Mm-hmm. I do like the character of Razumikin, because his function in the narrative in large part is that Raskolnikov is too bitter and bizarre to operate in society at large. So Razumikin does everything for him. He forces him into social interaction that he otherwise would not engage in a number of different times. So I like him as this kind of character who allows Raskolnikov to function as a member of society through him.
And Razumikin is also, he's such an inverse of Raskolnikov in that he sees the good in everything around him. He's constantly pumping up people. There's one point where Raskolnikov, he's trying to tell Raskolnikov what a good guy this one guy is, and Raskolnikov says, I think he gives bribes to officials. And Razumikin just cheerfully says, what of it? Who cares? I don't care if he gives bribes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he's a very cheerful and likable. He may be easily one of the most likable characters in the book, which is a welcome break, because Raskolnikov spends a lot of time with him and is personally deeply unlikable. Although it is worth noting, when talking about his relationship in particular to Sonya, that's born out of these... I described him earlier as having manic depressive episodes. His manic episodes take the form of intense charity that delights him just momentarily, though later he just becomes completely angry at himself for indulging in this kindness. So he, for instance, seemingly prevents a young woman from possibly being the victim of sexual assault by calling this policeman over when this, I think, a drunk young woman is being followed by this lascivious-looking man, and he donates every penny he has to Sonya's family for the burial of her father. And it kind of relates back to that dream about the mayor, because it's clear that in his childhood he was really sensitive. He had a lot of empathy for this dying horse, but as he's become older and more bitter, that part of him has been sort of buried deeper in what he is.
The thematic thing that's going on here is Raskolnikov's ideas about being the Übermensch are ultimately isolating him. That's his theories about being superior are what are isolating him from human contact, and he has this horror of the people around him. He finds them all disgusting or distasteful, or and the thing is that these manic moments when he's able to actually be a functioning human being, he kind of throws himself into social interaction kind of above and beyond what would be necessary, and he momentarily feels very pleased with himself, but then his intellect comes back in and he feels there's no point to it all, and he again isolates himself. I think that ultimately the book is kind of about the consequences of the ways in which you ideology can be an isolating.
He has this idea of being an exceptional figure along the lines of, most frequently he compares himself to Napoleon, who, if he had killed some lowly pawnbroker woman in order to achieve his goals of, you know, taking over most of Europe, it would have been considered nothing of consequence. But what exactly he intends to do in the long term to make himself such a remarkable person is never particularly clearly stated. He doesn't actually have any sort of long-term plan to become this supremely important figure in the current of human events. And he so deeply wants this achievement and recognition, but the only recognition he ever gets is when he has these manic episodes of pure kindness, and he immediately disregards them as foolish or folly. And later he learns that he got a small amount of recognition for his intellect because his article on crime was published, again, completely without his knowledge. So he seems completely blind to the times when he actually is being positively received by people, when he is being appreciated by people, including his family and Razumikin, who seem to be quite fond of him to the point that they're doing a lot of self-sacrificing.
That's funny, because that article you mentioned, that's brought up late in the novel. He basically wrote a treatise outlining this idea that the superior man should be allowed to commit crime or has the right to commit crime because, again, he's superior. It's sort of the equivalent of someone writing a book saying, "I did it."
Yeah, if this were an episode of CSI, the mystery would not be very intense. You would probably be able to pick that one apart relatively easily.
The whole thing between Dunya and I will adopt your suggestion and start calling him Arkady.
Yeah,
because
okay.
it's much more easy to refer to him by his given name than his family name. But Arkady, it comes to a head because Arkady, living right next door to Sonya, has overheard Raskolnikov talking to Sonya, first just almost getting to a confession, just saying, like, "I know who did it. I'll tell you next time."
Mm-hmm.
And Arkady says, "I guess I'll listen in next time." And then he hears Raskolnikov actually confess the crimes to Sonya, and he wants to use this as leverage against Dunya, and he invites Dunya over to his apartment and blackmails her. She pulls a gun on him, which turns out to have been his ex-wife's gun, and really, really late in the story to mm-hmm. be doing this. She pulls out this whole other thread that perhaps he had poisoned his wife. And I don't know where that came from. That kind of just is there to complicate matters.
I mean, you had mentioned that this was released, you know, in pieces at the time it was written. And I had actually heard a theory that there were some aspects of the story that when he was even writing the story, the earlier segments, Dostoevsky had not thought out or had not completely conceptualized, even to the point that prior to the actual murder itself, the idea of the exceptional man, it's clear that Raskolnikov is prideful and thinks himself and arrogant, but this exceptional man thread is never explicitly stated until well after the murder, possibly because at that time Dostoevsky hadn't completely conceptualized that idea in his head.
Well, this whole segment seems to me like the end of Clue, mm-hmm. in that it's just kind of pulling all kinds of threads of true crime stories together. Dunya is able to prevent her own rape at the hand of Arkady, but by shooting, but not fatally. She can't bring herself to actually shoot him, and it grazes his temple, and he grabs the gun and then just kind of walks off, and he has his own weird dark night of the soul. I don't know whether the intention is that he's become infected from the wound and this is causing him to have a fever, or whether he's just suffering some sort of a complete moral collapse. But he starts to like have bizarre hallucinations.
Mm-hmm.
He hallucinates that the city has become flooded. He hallucinates a teenage girl who's a drowned corpse, and then he hallucinates a very young girl dressed in muslin who he brings shivering into his room. It's all very creepy.
He's kind of a creepy character. He's earlier during a conversation with Raskolnikov is implied heavily to be also a pedophile, so that makes the scene with the young girl a little bit more a little darker, as it were.
He also talks to Raskolnikov about having an open marriage, which I thought was really a taboo subject for a 19th century novel. But he mentions like that, his wife had grown to accept the fact that he couldn't be faithful to her. Now that may not be an open marriage; that may just be like an enforced open marriage, in that he's not going to be faithful, and she just gave in.
Yeah, I mean, essentially in that chapter, they're throwing more and more red flags on this guy, one on top of another. I mean, they imply that he berated one of his former servants to the point that he committed suicide, that when he was younger, he probably committed a murder, that his later wife he manipulated into kind of getting him out of taking the rap for it. I suppose in many regards, he is an idealization of this kind of idea of an exceptional man who can do horrific things and has no regard for them. They do not stop him in any regard from continuing on with his life unbothered by the intense amounts of pain that he has caused, though ultimately when Dunya rejects him and his wife has died and he essentially has no connection left at the end of this weird night of terrors, he does kill himself. I'm not sure if the intention there is that he's so far removed at that point from all of the rest of humanity that he simply has no place left in it, or if there is some kind of moral, I guess, breaking point that kind of breaks like a dam in his head during this bizarre night of fever dreams.
The thing that was kind of weird about his eventual suicide, I mean, other than the fact that these feverish dreams that he has, and he dreams that he is talking to a soldier and saying that he's going to America when he shoots himself. I mean, the thing that's strange about this to me, not simply the highly surreal aspect of this chapter, which is quite unlike anything else, I think, in the book, but it just impressed upon me again how suicide seems to be ever present in these 19th century Russian stories. I mean, it's all over this book, like the specter of suicide hangs over a lot of people's heads. It certainly is all over the place in Chekhov. I wonder about that. I wonder whether or not that suicide was highly prevalent in 19th century Russia, or whether that was simply a literary device that everyone went back to. It disturbs me. I don't want to make light of it in any way, because it certainly is a problem we are better, we have a better handle on, recognizing that this is a very serious problem. And in these 19th century novels, it seems to me more like, well, there's a character I don't know what to do with, and I want to get rid of him, so I'll just make him have an unhappy night and commit suicide.
It's alluded to frequently. There are characters who contemplate it regularly. There's later in the novel, it's implied that the only possible end to this for Raskolnikov is to either turn himself in or to commit suicide. Of course, it's Arkady who's the one who says that. And I suppose the point of him saying that might be that obviously the path to redemption is to turn yourself in and endure the suffering that you have earned. And of course, this guy, as a complete heel and monster, opts for the other option of not enduring your punishment and exiting, rather than responding to the punishments that you would be placed upon you by society for your actions, only instead being held responsible to yourself and your own mind, I suppose. I don't know if it was more prevalent at the time. Certainly, the description of St. Petersburg is incredibly unpleasant in this book.
It's so nice in War and Peace. I don't.
I don't know. I guess two different areas.
Well, I guess yes. We were looking at social stratification here.
Bad part of town.
Right. After that, all wraps up with Arkady and with Dunya. Am I missing anything? This is about where the story comes to an end, where basically,
yeah,
Raskolnikov talking to Sonya. Sonya, as you mentioned, wants him to go the redemptive way, wants him to confess his sins. And interestingly, her prescription includes that he go to the center of town and kiss the ground and confess his sins to the earth, which is a kind of an oddly sort of pantheistic way of dealing with that for someone who is of Russian Orthodox faith. Up to the very, very end, it's not clear that Raskolnikov is going to give himself in. He walks over to the police office and he talks to the very same officer who he ran into on the first night when he'd been called in to the police station. It turned out he'd been called in because his landlady was filing a complaint against him for not paying his rent. But that's what first brought him to the attention of all the police officers there, when he showed up there and then fainted hearing about the murders. And he just kind of like chats with him. He's about to leave, actually, and I think he actually does go outside, and then he turns back in and he just gives himself up.
Yeah, he definitely steps completely outside of the station, because I believe after he steps out, he sees Sonya in the distance and kind of smiles before turning back in and immediately confessing his crime.
There's this epilogue in which we learn that that his pal Razumikin marries his sister, and his mom sadly dies because she can't take the sadness of Raskolnikov being sent to Siberia for 8 years, whatever it was. He turns out to get kind of a lenient sentence because of being contrite and cooperating entirely with the police at that point.
Sure.
In the epilogue, the narrator associates Raskolnikov's mental state to bad ideas circulating through Europe at the time. And I think that it's kind of like trying to create a sort of a political moral to this story that hasn't been to this point supported by the action of the book.
Right.
I do know that Dostoevsky himself was sentenced to a firing squad that turned out to not actually be a firing squad. It was just a show firing squad, and he was sent to Siberia for circulating revolutionary pamphlets. And some people see this book as his kind of coming to terms with his own youth spent in political radicalism and his reaction to that in later life and feeling that that had been a mistake. But it seems kind of, if that's the case, again, it seems imposed upon what up till now has been a very personal and very insular story.
Well, he was also greatly impoverished, but I think it's interesting because a lot of people, obviously, when they're younger, like the age that I think Raskolnikov is, but 22 or something during the course of this book, they flirt with more extreme ideas. Obviously, very few of them go to the extent of testing those theories by murdering two people. But I mean, obviously, I read it the first time when I was very young, and now I'm a little older. I'm still not entirely old, but I think that your reaction to this story would be greatly different depending on the age you are. If you're still in the kind of time period in your life where you are considering sort of more politically or philosophically more intense ideas, or if you've come to a point where you've kind of settled in your own mental understanding of yourself and the world to something that's a little bit more calmer, a little bit less chaotic in your own, in a sense. Yeah, I do feel like the reaction would just be wildly different between somebody who's 20 and somebody who is probably, I don't know, in their 30s or older.
The moral at the end is very conservative and very sort of reactionary, insofar as we're told at the very last line of the book that Sonya is waiting for Raskolnikov and there will be an eventual redemption. And so redemption for Raskolnikov lies in domesticity, in the life of the family, in, one assumes, a reawakening of his Christian faith, because Sonya is devout and there's this idea that the redemption is going to come through religion. After all of this crazy, as you say, the radicalism of youth, the final answer is in standard things: domestic life, faith. As a contemporary reader, I look at this and I think, yeah, but St. Petersburg is still a rat hole.
Yeah.
You know, everyone is still living in poverty. Sonya is still having to prostitute herself to support her family. Although, I guess by this point, her mother dies as well. So,
well, there is, yeah. Another thing that's implied that Arkady does is he sets up the children in this very high-end orphanage and sets aside a great deal of money for their further education. Though it's implied the reason he did that was to have greater access to the young girl, to have her be beholden to him, because obviously he's a very creepy, disgusting individual. But with his suicide, obviously, that trust is still set up. So her family seems to be taken care of. And in her new life in Siberia, at the very least, she is, I guess, a dressmaker or something of that nature.
Oh, right, right. Yeah. I guess, ultimately, I like the book a lot, but I find the ending troubling because I feel as though there are problems in the world of St. Petersburg that are not the same problems that Raskolnikov sees because he's too wrapped up in himself, but they are the problems that make it possible for someone like a Raskolnikov to come along. And I agree that as you say, when you're young, you become radicalized, and you can try out some very extreme ideas, but the reasons that those ideas can flourish have to do with actual things. You know, obviously, this is taking place in 1860, and revolution isn't very far away here in Russia. I can't help but think about Raskolnikov again in terms of contemporary self-centeredness that a lot of people feel, or the idea that the collapse of belief in the social fabric. I worry about these things on the eve of a very contentious election. But you again, what do you think? How long has it been now? How old are you? Sorry, you're.
I'm presently 28. So
it's been
approximately half of my life.
Half of your life since you read this book. Well, it's been like I was 11 and now I'm 48. So it's been a little longer for me. But did you like it this time? Did you?
There were aspects of it I did and did not care for. Sometimes I did find the writing style to be a little unengaging, a little bland, and the prolonged periods of his wandering around St. Petersburg, going through these radical shifts in mentality, I found myself drifting a little bit. And this might just be because of personal inclinations, this is not something that particularly interests me as a person, but the heavy religious influence didn't connect with me. There's a scene where Sonia and Raskolnikov read the story of the raising of Lazarus, and I think I might have skimmed harder at that particular part in the book than any other part during my entire reading.
Well, that comes late in the book, so at least... Yeah.
I understand your grievance with the fact that they present these answers that are like a very domestic and conservative sort of and Christian response to the things that grieve Raskolnikov and how they don't address the problems that are at large in St. Petersburg, but neither the characters nor the book itself seems to be overly concerned about rectifying those problems. I mean, it's entirely an internal struggle, and the last page of the book certainly implies that this, it says that there's a story for another time of his great suffering in his new life and all the costs he would have to pay. So clearly this is the story of him accepting the idea of redemption and not actually the, technically not even the punishment, which would come later. But putting aside sort of those heavy Christian themes, I mostly enjoyed it. There were scenes that I thought were arresting or tense. I kind of enjoyed, as surreal as it was, the bizarre last night of Arkady. I liked some, to an extent, the back and forth between Porfiry and Raskolnikov when they were trying to kind of catch each other in these games. As you say, there may have been one or two too many of those. And these bizarre... There's a bizarre aside with Luzin where he tries to frame Sonia just to drag Raskolnikov through the mud. That was bizarre, but kind of I enjoyed as a series of sort of coincidental occurrences that happened on the side, though they are not particularly relevant to the core story. I think overall I did enjoy it, with the exception of a few points where I found myself drifting heavily and losing interest. I went through the entire thing without too much complaint, except for putting it down just a couple of times.
You shouldn't complain. You were the one who chose it.
Yeah, that's true. It was a long time. It's been a long time, so.
Thanks again to Zach Powers. Look for his podcasts, The Revisionists and Stage of Fools, wherever fine podcasts are sold. Thanks once again to Malcolm Nygaard for the Sophomore Lit theme song. You can find his podcasts and other stuff at apocgraffiti.com. If you like discussing books or high school, join us on the Sophomore Lit Facebook page. Or if you'd like to send me an email, you may do so at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts at theincomparable.com. Next episode, we continue our Russian readings with Chekhov's The Seagull. And remember, everything will be on the final.